Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Norman Solomon, co-founder and coordinator of the online organization RootsAction.org, who discusses the petition drive underway to initiate an impeachment investigation into President Trump's business practices. Matt Wood, policy director with the group Free Press, who examines the new direction of Donald Trump's Federal Communications Commission and the plan to scrap net neutrality. And Fatima Rojas, a leader of the Connecticut group Unidad Latina en Acción, who talks about her group's outreach effort to immigrant communities living in fear of Donald Trump's mass deportation plan. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A Senate committee in Australia's parliament is preparing a consensus same-sex marriage bill that includes limited rights for clergy to refuse to bless gay unions, but rejects a broad conscientious objector clause. Gay rights activists pushing for the consensus bill are seeking support from moderate members of the ruling Liberal Party, in addition to opposition Labour and Green Party members. Yet the legislation still faces resistance from the Liberal Party's Conservative Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, who had pledged to hold a national plebiscite on same-sex marriage. Longtime marriage equality advocate Rodney Croom praised the consensus bill for rejecting outright discrimination against same-sex couples and showing marriage equality is possible when our elected officials work across party lines. If passed, the bill would require civil celebrants to marry any couple who has the right to get married. However, clergy would retain the right to refuse to conduct same-sex marriage ceremonies on the basis of religious doctrine. After years of rapid economic growth, Singapore has among the lowest fertility rates in the world, 1.24 births per woman, far below the rate necessary to maintain a stable population. During decades of fear about a population explosion, Singapore and other emerging Asian nations made intensive family planning a priority. Now, with an aging workforce, Singapore is paying subsidies to young couples to defray the cost of raising children. Young families get priority in housing allotments, and Singapore's government has also begun sponsoring a dating service. In 2015, the most recent year with available statistics, more than 33,000 children were born in Singapore, the highest number in more than a decade. According to the Christian Science Monitor, developed nations ranging from Denmark to Japan are coming to terms with shrinking populations and increased budget demands to care for aging citizens. Many advocates for the poor question the reliability of the biennial street census of homeless people across the U.S. Critics say the census, taken by volunteers on a single night with little more than a clipboard, pencil, and flashlight, is flawed and likely substantially inaccurate. Supporters of the homeless count say it is vital for communities to get a sense of trends of people living on the street. University of Pennsylvania researcher Dennis Culhane told The Guardian newspaper, "The bottom line is that the count is imperfect, but I don't know if we could do a better job." Recent single-night homeless counts have found nearly 550,000 homeless people across America. But Culhane also says federal officials are aware these figures only provide a snapshot. While the count identifies around 500,000 homeless Americans on a given night, Culhane uses data extrapolations to estimate that some 2 million Americans experience homelessness at some point over the course of a year. In recent years, the scale of homelessness has spiked, particularly in western states, including California, Nevada, Oregon, and Hawaii. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The first month of Donald Trump's presidency has been rocked by chaotic White House mismanagement of a series of events, including investigations into the Trump campaign's links with Russian government officials, the sloppy and unconstitutional rollout of the so-called Muslim ban that was successfully overturned in federal court, the firing of Michael Flynn as national security advisor for lying to the vice president, and a constant stream of lies and misinformation coming from both the president and his spokespersons. With the worst public approval ratings of any new U.S. president in modern American history, and a burgeoning protest movement that has seen the mobilization of literally millions of people in opposition to the Trump agenda, the situation looks pretty bleak for a president who's supposed to be in his honeymoon period. Now, two organizations, RootsAction.org and Free Speech for People, have collected and delivered over 850,000 petition signatures to Congress, calling on legislators in the House of Representatives to initiate an impeachment investigation into President Trump's business dealings that appear to violate the U.S. Constitution's Foreign and Domestic Emoluments Clauses and other federal law. Those constitutional provisions prohibit the president from personally profiting from his position beyond his government salary. Representative Gerald Nadler, a Democrat of New York, has filed a resolution of inquiry to the Justice Department, asking officials there to provide to Congress any information they have relating to any violation of the Constitution by Mr. Trump, which could be the first step in Congress toward impeachment. Your reporter spoke with Norman Solomon, co-founder and coordinator of the online organization RootsAction.org, who discusses the petition drive underway to initiate an impeachment investigation into President Trump's business ethics.
Really, there are so many people who have a wide range of concerns, to put it mildly: alarm, anger, willingness and eagerness to push back against the Trump presidency. And in that mix, and necessarily, we have to be on defense to defend the gains that people have won over 20, 30 years and more. I think it's also important for us to take the offense on the question of legality of this presidency. And there is the Constitution of the United States that has two clauses known as the Foreign Emoluments Clause and Domestic Emoluments Clause that require the kind of lack of conflict of interest that, in fact, President Trump is totally in violation of. And so that's it in a nutshell. At ImpeachDonaldTrumpNow.org, we have 880,000 signers on a petition for the initiation of a impeachment process in the Congress.
Norman, just spell out in a little bit more detail, what are the grounds upon which this petition is based to launch an impeachment effort against Donald Trump? So early in his presidency, a lot of people will say, hey, has he really crossed the line yet?
Well, he crossed the line the moment he became president. And that's, I think, a very important point that our news media have not really been getting into. You know, the minority leader of the House, Nancy Pelosi, has said publicly, well, if the president violates the law, then we will look at impeachment. But in fact, the moment he became president, because of his refusal to set up anything approximating a blind trust, I call it a 2020 trust he has, he knows exactly what he's invested in, what the Trump Organization is invested in. He's been, from the very beginning of his presidency, in violation of these two key clauses of the Constitution. One forbids the president or a top official of the government from being financially entangled with a foreign government or entity. And the Trump Organization, you know, you can go to Saudi Arabia and the Philippines and Turkey, where there are huge investments that Trump has, which he has refused to divest himself from whatsoever. And then I think probably even more important is Article 2, Section 7 of the U.S. Constitution, the so-called Domestic Emoluments Clause or Presidential Compensation Clause, that singles out the president. There's no way that the Congress can waive this requirement. That part of the Constitution names the president as somebody who absolutely cannot benefit from any policies or entities of the 50 states of the United States or the U.S. government. And yet, whether you look at Trump Towers or you look at the new Trump Hotel opened right next to the White House, you have a situation where Trump personally and his family and his corporation are benefiting enormously from all sorts of tax breaks, waivers, leases, regulatory decisions of the states and of the federal government. So It's really a question, I think, Scott, of is the president above the law? And if we're going to give him a pass and say, well, for some reason or another, it doesn't matter that he has been violating the Constitution and continues to do so, then we're saying that the most powerful position in the U.S. government is held by somebody who is violating the Constitution 24/7, and that we're going to let that go. And I think that should be totally unacceptable.
There's been a recent public opinion poll asking the survey sample specifically about impeachment. And it turns out, I think as we all know, the country is quite polarized. And it was 46-46 for and against impeachment, with I guess about 8% who really didn't have an opinion yet. What does that poll say to you so early in a new president's term of office that we have the country split on the question of impeachment?
Well, for one thing, in a two-week period, the number went from 35% to 46% in support. So it says to me that the enthusiasm for impeachment is growing as people see what the Trump presidency actually means. It also says to me that there's an enormous gap, whether you talk about the members of the House from Connecticut or anywhere else in the country, an enormous gap between the viewpoints of people around the United States. As you noted, 46% support impeachment, willing to say so, and 0% of the members of the House of Representatives willing to say that they support impeachment. And this is classic. I really believe that it's true. When the people lead, the leaders will follow. At least the leaders can be made to follow. And this is an enormous gap that we need to close. And it doesn't mean that the grassroots needs to go along with the cowardice of people in Congress. It means people in Congress need to be compelled during their recess period and ongoing. They need to be compelled by hearing from constituents to step up to the plate and get impeachment done.
That was author and activist Norman Solomon, co-founder and coordinator of the online organization RootsAction.org. For more information on the campaign to impeach President Trump, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On February 26, 2015, the Federal Communications Commission voted in favor of a new regulation that reclassified broadband internet as a public utility under Title II of the Communications Act. The new rules that went into effect in June 2015 prohibited internet service providers, including cellular carriers, from blocking, slowing down, or speeding up online traffic, or giving priority to web services in exchange for payment. This regulatory doctrine, commonly known as net neutrality, had been at the heart of political battles since the 1990s. Now, just 21 months after net neutrality rules came into force, President Trump's newly appointed chair of the Federal Communications Commission, former Verizon attorney Ajit Pai, has taken quick action to reverse consumer protections initiated during President Obama's 8 years in office. A Republican appointee serving on the FCC for the past 3 years, Pai has long been an opponent of net neutrality. Upon being elevated to chair, he released a blizzard of actions that included halting 9 companies from providing discounted high-speed broadband internet service to low-income households, revoking a program to keep prison phone rates low, and discarding a proposal to require pay TV providers to make video programming available to the makers of third-party devices and software, saving consumers monthly cable box rental fees. Your reporter spoke with Matt Wood, policy director with the media democracy group FreePress.net, who examines the new direction of Donald Trump's FCC and the future of net neutrality under his chairman, Ajit Pai.
The FCC, there are 5 commissioners, but it is very much a top-down organization from the chair. The chair controls all of the other offices and bureaus within the commission. So it's probably fairest to think of it as a really steep pyramid with the chairman at the top of it, and the other 4 commissioners get votes, but they don't get to set the agenda. They're also, in addition to political pressure, though, are administrative law and court decisions and the legal framework within which the FCC has to act and the statutes that it's bound by that are passed by Congress. So I guess I would say, you know, we're optimistic about beating back these attacks, but we're not naive about how hard it's going to be. And as chairman, Chairman Pai has, I wouldn't say unlimited power, but lots of power to set the agenda. He has to then try to complete these tasks within the framework of the rulemakings and the other formal proceedings they have at the FCC. And those have to survive appellate review, as the net neutrality rules themselves did just last year when they went up and won in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. So there are a lot of things constraining his ability to do all these bad things, including the people listening to this program who can make their views known at the FCC once again. But that doesn't mean he doesn't have a lot of ways to try to undo them over the coming weeks and months.
Just to review the mechanism for undoing net neutrality, for instance, is it a simple vote of the FCC, or does this have to go to a court for any kind of review, as I think you just indicated?
Well, both. So any federal agency can take a vote and try to make a rule or undo a rule. To get there, they have to have reasons for their decision-making. So it's not like they can just go in tomorrow and say, you know what, we've changed our mind and this is voting day. They have to ask questions. They have to take input from the public. Typically, if you look at the administrative laws that govern all these agencies, it's called notice and comment rulemaking. So the agency provides all of us with notice of what they intend to do, and we get a chance to comment. And there are other ways he can try to chip away at it. You know, they could issue some orders without really seeking comment, but that's not a very good way to survive court challenge. They could simply ignore the rules and not try to take them off the books, but refuse to enforce them. They could drop their defense of the rules that are still in court, because there's a small chance that the rules that are in place now will continue on their way through the appellate process and wind up in the Supreme Court, as a predecessor version of them did about a decade ago. So Chairman Pai will have lots of opportunities to either undo or chip away at the rules. We're not sure exactly which one of those he'll take. Personally, I don't think any of them are particularly appealing to him, because even though he has a strong ideology against these rules, they're very popular. What has become a partisan issue inside of D.C. and inside the Beltway here where I am is not really all that political outside of it. You know, most people, Democrat or Republican alike, don't want Comcast or AT&T telling them what they can do on the Internet. So I think he'll face a lot of opposition if he tries to really dismantle the rules. And as I was saying earlier, whatever he does can be taken to a higher court, and we've seen that happen time again with the FCC. They haven't always won, and in fact, sometimes we've beaten them. But this last time around, we agreed with them about how they finally got to good net neutrality rules, and those did stand up in court just last June.
Well, Matt, just to wrap up here before we conclude, what are some of the strategies that your group, Free Press, and other allies will be looking into to mobilize opposition to some of these very major changes that this new FCC chair, with the support of Donald Trump, are going to be pushing?
Yeah, he's appointed by the president, and Donald Trump, who supposedly has a populist veneer. I have yet to really see it outside of Twitter rants, but, you know, in theory, he's not supposed to be just doing what big corporations want. I don't think his cabinet has gotten the memo. Ajit Pai is also from a corporate background, and we're worried that he will try to basically do what's good for cable and phone companies and not for real people. All that said, he does have to do things within the law at the FCC, and then that has to pass muster in appellate court. And so we have legal filings we can make at the FCC to try to slow them down or convince them that the conclusions they might come to are wrong. We can sue them in court if we don't like the final decision. And then Congress is yet another playing field here where, you know, there might be people trying to change the law for the worse and taking power away from the FCC, or I guess in this context, giving Pai more power to do bad things. We'll fight them there as well. The key ingredient for all of that, I mean, other than the courts, which are a little bit more impervious to political pressure, we hope, but both in Congress and at the FCC, it's not just a matter of the filings that Free Press and other groups make. It really is public comment, and has been for the last decade and a half or so. A key component of everything we do is helping real people to make their voices heard in these FCC proceedings, because they're, you know, something of a dry legal setting in some ways. But I think, as we've seen over the last few weeks of people calling their members of Congress and resisting a lot of the bad things coming out of this administration, that really matters. You know, people on the phones and sometimes even people in the streets, coupled with the lawyers' filings that we hope we can make pretty well down here from our offices in Washington. So it's really an all-of-the-above strategy. And As I said, we're not naive about how hard it's going to be, but we are optimistic that people can win despite the power that this new administration is trying to exercise right out of the gate.
That was Matt Wood, policy director with the media democracy group Free Press. For more information on the fight to save net neutrality and related policies, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Of all the many opponents of the Trump administration agenda, perhaps the most urgent and vocal is that of immigrants and their allies, who protest against Trump's promise to build a wall and deport most or all of the 11 million immigrants here without papers. The recent arrest of a young man in Washington state with legal status under DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, sent a chill through the nation's undocumented immigrant community, as did the February 21st announcement by the Department of Homeland Security of new orders for stricter immigration enforcement. In Connecticut, dozens of rallies, marches, prayer vigils, and other actions have taken place in the months since Trump took office. Supporters have assisted immigrants to write testimony against legislation that would roll back their rights, and more than 300 recently attended a meeting in New Haven to learn how to accompany immigrants to their deportation hearings. Immigrants and their advocates are also reaching out to threatened communities to inform them of possible actions by the Federal Office of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and how they can protect themselves. On February 18th, volunteers fanned out around Fairhaven, a New Haven neighborhood with a large immigrant population. They spoke with more than 100 residents and business owners about the current threat. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Fatima Rojas, a leader of the pro-immigrant group Unidad Latina en Acción, who talks about her group's neighbor-to-neighbor outreach effort.
The goal of canvassing, it is to be in touch with the immigrant community, to bring to their homes the Know Your Rights kit. And, of course, we are advising them in what to do if immigration customs enforcement knock on their door, to make sure that they identify first who is at the door. Instead of just going and quickly open the door, we want to make sure that people see who is out there, if they feel safe, come to the door, but not only they are sure they can open the door. So we were distributing posters that we recommended to put it in the entrance of the door. And that way they know, like if an ICE agent is at the door, they should not open the door. They should ask if they have a warrant to pass it through the door. And also to let them know if they are at the workplace, if they are in church, if they are doing their groceries, what to do if they got stopped by an immigration police or an agent that comes from the Customs Enforcement Office, to say their name and then handing them, we are handing cards, wallet cards that have the right, like they have the right to remain silent, just say the name, and then they have the right to call a lawyer.
So how did the canvassing go?
Yeah, I mean, we found people at the end. In our team, we tallied the results. We spoke with 103 people. Once they saw, of course, that we were not ICE, so they opened the door. They were very receptive, and they were very grateful for the information that they were receiving. Even there was a lady that says, oh, I'd like you to meet my pastor, and I'd like you to come to my church and do a Know Your Rights workshop in my church.
Did you find people who said they were afraid?
You can see the fear speaking about this and asking questions about, okay, so, but there is a lawyer that we can trust if something happens. So people are very concerned.
Now, you had the information in Spanish and English, but it was pointed out that there are undocumented immigrants from many countries where people speak other languages.
Yeah, no, in fact, we make the commitment to translate the document one of our members has connections with the Middle East community to translate it into maybe Arabic. I think that there were conversations to see if we can translate this in Farsi, in Mandarin too. People from China and other places around that speak Chinese or Mandarin that also are in the same situation.
Fatima Rojas, you did this outreach work on Saturday, and then on Sunday, 300 people came to a synagogue in the New Haven area to learn how they could support undocumented immigrants by accompanying them in various ways, like going to immigration court or providing transportation. You were one of the speakers. How did you feel about that event?
I felt great. I feel that it was a great event because even though we are facing a really challenging and very backwards situation here with all these executive orders that the actual president is signing, also, there is a huge positive vibe among a diverse community that want to do something. People that I asked 1 year ago, can you please help my husband to sign this petition for his place that he's trying to unionize, and say, well, no, I cannot sign anything. I cannot get active in the community in this way. The same people now is saying, how can we help? Can we help? How can we plug in? There is a lot of people that want to do something. They are willing to do surveys. They are willing to do canvassing. They are willing to give rides, as you are mentioning. They are also offering their houses. If there is a family or there is a couple or there are kids that need a place, a safe place to stay, if there is a raid or if they are in any kind of danger, immigration danger per se. So just to see that crystallize in that room with 300 people is a huge positive statement of unity, and it brings a lot of hope to what we are trying to protect our community.
That was Fatima Rojas, a leader of the immigrant advocacy group Unidad Latina en Acción in New Haven, Connecticut. Learn more about immigrant advocacy organizations' response to the Trump administration's ICE crackdown by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.